This is audiobook of Andrea Puharich about the mystic contacts and life of Uri Geller. Preface, back cover of book. In 1971 Andrea Puharich met a talented young Israeli named Uri Geller, whose psychic abilities had already made him well known in his homeland. The next year Uri came to America, where millions of people have since watched him bend keys, stop watches, and break metal rings, with no apparent physical pressure. So far no one has been able to explain successfully how he does these things. But these remarkable talents are only the beginning of the story told in this book. Out of the friendship between Dr. Puharich and Uri Geller grew one of the most extraordinary adventures of a lifetime. Not long after their first meeting, according to Puharich, they were contacted by Spectra, a voice they believed to represent an extraterrestrial intelligence called Hoover. This is Dr. Puharich's account of how he and Uri thus became the first individuals in modern history believed to have made extended contact with non-earthly beings, how Hoover explained the source of Uri's psychic powers, and what they learned about the relationship between this intelligence and the inhabitants of Earth. Andrea Puharich is a medical doctor. After completing his studies at Northwestern University Medical School, he set up his own laboratory in Maine for the study of extrasensory perception. He has studied some of the most noteworthy examples of paranormal activity that have occurred in modern times, many of which are detailed in his earlier books, Beyond Telepathy and the Sacred Mushroom. Preface, further. In late 1970 I read a report written by an Israeli army officer about a young man in Israel named Uri Geller. The letter described Geller's telepathic powers and his ability to make clock hands move without touching the clock. These alleged powers were so extraordinary that I could not believe the report. However, when this officer subsequently sent samples of metal broken by Geller's mental powers, and when the laboratory reports stated that this kind of metal fracture had not been seen before, my interest grew. I went to Tel Aviv, Israel, on August 17, 1971, to meet Uri Geller. My research with him convinced me that he was one of the most unusual men in the world. Why I think he is so unusual is the subject of this book. I had suspected for a long time from my researches that man has been in communication with beings not of this earth for thousands of years. This personal opinion comes from a close reading of the record of ancient religions and from my own observations and data. What is not clear is why such communication has been kept secret for so long. With the publication of this book, however, many of the cosmic secrets are now declassified. But the release of this knowledge in fact raises more questions than it answers. One of the first of these new questions is an important one: why was Uri Geller selected to be the ambassador for an advanced civilization? Why did I become the principal witness to this ambassadorship and the chief scribe of its gradually unfolding revelations? These interrelated questions will be developed throughout this book. My story involves three principal agents. The primary agent is not a single being, but a collegium of voices reaching man on Earth. We have, in the beginning, the words of the Nine, who are directly related to man's concept of God. I shall develop the concept of the Nine in the introduction. The controllers of the universe operate under the direction of the Nine. Between the controllers and the untold numbers of planetary civilizations in the universe are the messengers. It is the messengers who help to fulfill the destiny of creation by gentle accentuation where and when they are needed. Some of these messengers take the form of spacecraft, which in modern parlance are called unidentified flying objects, or UFOs. Uri and I have been reached mostly by the latter type of messenger, whose names and functions are varied. The intermediary between these messengers and Earth people is Uri Geller. The function of chief witness to these interactions has fallen upon me. If I am to get an attentive hearing, the reader should know that I have had many years of professional preparation and research experience in medicine, parapsychology, and laboratory and field investigations. I have only one interest in writing this book, that is to bring to people all over the world the facts about the existence of superior beings and what they want to say to man today. What follows is true, but it is not the whole truth. There are many things that my editor in the sky will not yet permit me to reveal. My editor on Earth has advised me to delete material that could be considered too controversial or libelous. Events have been omitted for political reasons where governments have been involved. There are delicate questions concerning the relations between religions which have been avoided. In order to get the basic message in print, and out to the people, many diplomatic gestures have had to be made. Perhaps someday, depending on the response of the public, my editors will allow the whole truth to be revealed. Many people are mentioned in this book for the roles they played in the reported events. I have been in touch with these principals in order to compare my text with their recollections. The text that follows represents the agreement reached between each principal, whom I could reach, and myself. However, I want to make it clear that this does not mean that these individuals have necessarily endorsed the content or conclusions of this book. I stand alone with respect to the reporting of all events, interpretations, and conclusions. Introduction. Once I realized I was involved in an event of immense importance, I began to retrace those incidents in my life which brought Uri and me together. The first of these concerns Dr. D.G. Vinod, a Hindu scholar and sage from Pune, India, whom I briefly met by chance in New York City in December 1951. 2 months later, on February 16, 1952, I had my first serious meeting with him. At that time he surprised me by asking permission to hold my right ring finger at the middle joint with his right thumb and index finger. He said that he used this form of contact with a person to read his past and his future. I agreed. He did this for about a minute, whistling between his teeth as though he were trying to find a pitch. Then he leaned back in his chair, and for an hour told me my life story with utter precision, as though he were reading out of a book. His accuracy about the past was extraordinary. He then predicted such a rosy future for me as an Arjuna figure that I was embarrassed. Nevertheless, I realized that here was intelligence on a scale I had not imagined to exist. I promised Dr. Vinod that I would call him to the laboratory in Maine as soon as my next experiment was ready. As it turned out, this promised meeting was not to be held for nearly another year. On December 31, 1952, Dr. Vinod and I took a plane from New York to Maine. We landed in Augusta at 7:30 p.m., and Hank Jackson, the administrator of the laboratory, the Round Table Foundation, was there to meet us. We drove over the country roads in the snow, chatting all the way. We entered the great hall of the laboratory, and without saying a word or even taking off his overcoat, Dr. Vinod found his way to the library and sat down on a sofa. Hank and I followed him. We realized that he had gone into a trance. We sat opposite him, waiting expectantly. Curiously enough, the house was always bustling with activity, but on this New Year's Eve there was not a sound in the house from child, man, woman, or animal. There was the hushed silence of expectancy as Hank and I watched our entranced sage. Then, at exactly 9 p.m., a deep sonorous voice came out of Dr. Vinod's mouth, totally unlike his own high-pitched, soft voice, saying in perfect English without an accent, "M calling, we are 9 principles and forces, personalities if working in complete mutual implication. We are forces, and the nature of our work is to accentuate the positive, the evolutional, and the teleological aspects of existence. By teleology I do not mean the teleology of human derivation in a multidimensional concept of existence. Teleology will be understood in terms of a different ontology. To be simple, we accentuate certain directions as will fulfill the destiny of creation. We propose to work with you in some essential respects with the relation of contradiction and contrariety. We shall negate and revise part of your work, by which I mean the work as presented by you. The point is that we want to begin altogether at a different dimension, though it is true that your work has itself led up to this. I deeply appreciate your dedicatedness, Sikh, to the great cause of peace which is a fulfillment of finitesimal existences. Peace is not warlessness. Peace is the integral fruitage of personality. We have designed to utilize you and thus to fulfill you. Peace is a process and will be revealed only progressively. You have it in plenty. I mean the patience which is so deeply needed in this magnificent adventure. But today, at the moment of our advent, the most eventful and spectacular phase of your work begins. Andhra Puharaj, app, it is helpful to have your guidance. We don't guide, nor do we seek guidance, although we appreciate the sense in which you mean it. All of us, including yourselves, can claim no better than being the expressive instruments and avenues of this purpose. Einstein has privately felt the need of correcting himself. Infinitization of any mass, M1, according to him, 1, can be achieved by equating it with, an implication of this theorem, as yet unrevealed, will solve the problem of the superconscious. The whole group of concepts has to be revised, the problem of psychokinesis, clairvoyance, etc., at the present stage is all right, but profoundly misleading. Permit us to say the truth. Soon we will come to basic universal categories of explicating the superconscious. Just as Jesus said, it is not work, but grace. A fruitful, creative approach to the superconscious is indeed a progressive reception of grace. We cannot really go on with experimentation in this direction, but if we get 7 times the electrical equivalent of a human body, if we get it 7 times, do you know what would result? It would result in 7 of the mass of electricity. That's a very strange term, but it's true. If it gains 7-fold, corresponding approximation to light velocity will be 99%. That is the point where human personality has to be stretched in order to achieve infinitization. This is one of the most secret insights. See Appendix 1 for the philosophy of the 9. 1. This is a form of the well-known Lorentz-Einstein transformation equation where c2 is velocity of light squared, and v is velocity. Here, m1 equals e, energy. When Dr. Vinod awoke from his trance after some 90 minutes of speech by the 9, he had no recollection or knowledge of what had been said. Hank and I worked for a month with Dr. Vinod, listening to the profound wisdom of the 9. It was a deeply moving experience. And we really believed every word that we heard based purely on the internal evidence. This work was interrupted in February 1953 when I had to serve as a captain in the U.S. Army during the Korean War. What was lacking in our study of Dr. Vinod and the 9 was some kind of external evidence for the reality of what was being said. Such evidence was forthcoming and occurred when I returned to the laboratory in Maine on a military leave. On June 27, 1953, 9 people met with Dr. Vinod at the Round Table Foundation in Maine. They were Henry Jackson, Georgia Jackson, Alice Bouverie, Marcela DuPont, Carl Bitz, Vonnie Beck, Arthur Young, Ruth Young, and I. Dr. Vinod sat on the floor in the lotus posture holding in his hands a string of sacred beads, called rakshas. On his lap was a simple copper plate 9 inches in diameter. On the floor to his side was a small statue of the Hindu god. Thus, Dr. Vinod was in the center of a circle made up of the 9 people listed above. He entered a trance state at 12:15 a.m. He spoke for about 15 minutes and then one of the 9, spoke through him, saying, "Tonight we want to create Brahmins in this world." Brahmin means a person dedicated to Brahman. At this instant all 9 observers in the fully lighted room saw the appearance, in an instant, of what appeared to be a pile of cotton threads about 3 feet from Dr. Vinod. It seemed to this observer that the pile of thread had just popped right out of the wood floor. Dr. Vinod, still in a trance state, leaned over to pick up the threads. When he untangled them, he brought forth loops of finely woven cotton cord. He handed one to each person and there was exactly 1 loop for each. He asked each person to slip the loop over the right shoulder and under the left arm. What we had witnessed was the appearance of a material substance from nowhere. All present were quite sure that the large ball of cotton material had come from the floor and no place other than the floor. R spoke, "Has everyone received one? This is called the Yajnapavita. These are the sacred threads which Brahmins wear on their necks, as soon as they are through with the ceremony. We have to be born twice, unless we are threaded, we don't become Brahmins. This is the sacred thread which makes the human being the Brahmin. Each one of you becomes a Brahmin on this full moon day." Alchemy had 3 different areas of function. It really wanted to solve the problem of deterioration, disease, and death. All metals are really gold in one way, but deteriorated gold. So transformation of the lesser, grosser metals into gold was one idea. The second was to find an elixir to eliminate all disease from the human body, and the third was to produce the nectar to eliminate death. These three threads on this sacrificial thread stand for each of these functions. Altogether there are 15 threads. I don't know how many you have, that's perhaps the symbol of the full moon. Of course, you will that know that alchemy is actually operative whenever we are forcing a crisis on ourselves, or permitting a crisis to be forced on us, we are exposed to alchemy. Of course, Al means God, and Chem means Egypt, therefore alchemy is God of Egypt, and God of Egypt was this. It's very strange that the life of Buddha had these same three crises in it, the sight of disease, and the sight of death, and the sight of old age, which is deterioration. He had never been exposed to these crises. He lived like a plant in a green room. Suddenly he came across these three instances, as he was passing through a street in a chariot. He came home and he couldn't rest and asked himself, why must the human body deteriorate? Why disease? Why death? And he went out of his palace at midnight. He left a wife and newly born son. I don't know why I'm speaking this, but I think it has some reference to some of you already exposed to emotional, spiritual, and perhaps financial crisis. An alchemist process to which we are addressed, let us welcome it. I cannot go into all the details of the meaning of these trance utterances by Dr. Vinod. The material that was given would fill another volume, and only a small sample is presented in Appendix 1 to give a synoptic view of the philosophy of the Nine. We took every known precaution against fraud, and the staff and I became thoroughly convinced that we were dealing with some kind of an extraordinary extraterrestrial intelligence. But for this belief we had no solid proof in 1953. 3 years later, I was called to Mexico to help solve an archaeological problem. With me was Peter Hercos, one of the great telepathic talents of modern times. Peter and I arrived in the colonial village of Acambaro, Mexico, on July 26, 1956. Rooms had been reserved for us at the only hotel in town. When we got there, we found that the only two good rooms in the hotel had been given to an American family by mistake. But it was late at night, so we accepted two strange windowless rooms and planned to get more decent accommodations by discussing the problem the next day with the Americans who had been given our rooms. In the morning we met the Americans, a Dr. and Mrs. Charles Laughhead from Whipple, Arizona. We could not understand why they were so happy to see us and why they so gladly gave up their lovely, sunny quarters in exchange for our drab, dark ones. When Dr. Laughhead, who was a medical doctor, found out that I was an MD and that Peter was a psychic, he was beside himself with joy. He then told us the following story, through the assistance of a young man, who is a very fine voice channel or medium. We have been in frequent communication for over a year with the Brotherhood of one of the ancient mystery schools in South America. These sessions covered a wide range of subjects, from ancient history and life origins on this planet to science and religion. This brotherhood also served as a communication center for contacts with intelligences on other planets and star systems and on spacecraft. Some of these intelligences obviously were not human and operated on energy and life support mechanisms entirely foreign to our thinking. Their knowledge and wisdom far exceeded our comprehension. For simplicity, we referred to them as space beings or space brothers. In one of these sessions our attention was directed to the story of the arrival on Earth of men from outer space in very ancient times. This landing took place on a small island near Easter Island, called Mangareva. We were then told that the clay figurines at Acambaro, Mexico, would corroborate by certain clues the story about these early space travelers. We were then directed to search out a possible location for continuing study and research in Mexico, and on this scouting trip we naturally came to visit the library of figurines at Acambaro. Because of the unusual nature of this meeting with you gentlemen and the work under investigation, we feel you must be related in some way to the unfolding story of the ancient mystery of man in space, even though at the present time you may not have recall of previous life cycles on this and on other planets. The voices of our mentors speaking through our young channel sounded so authoritative that we felt impelled to follow through with their suggestions and come to Mexico. And here we are, having arrived only an hour before you. Are you not brothers from space? Dr. Laughhead stared at us so intently as he said this that for a moment I thought, maybe I am. But then Peter and I looked at each other and burst out laughing. The whole idea was just too absurd. Peter hastily said in his broken English, Master, I'm born right in my mother's bed. I'm no space mensch. We talked for an hour to these charming but naive people, to no avail. They were firmly convinced of the authenticity of their message. They coaxed us to admit our true space origins. We gently but firmly backed away. We then bade them goodbye and went off to take care of our business. During our stay there we carefully avoided seeing the Laughheads again. This Space Brothers talk was just too wild for our tastes. On August 15, 1956, I received a letter at the Round Table Foundation from Dr. Laughhead, mailed on August 12, from Whipple, Arizona. The envelope was addressed to Dr. Andy Poharitz, misspelled. The letter, labeled by me as Test No. 1, read as follows, Test No. Idea Dr. Faritz, again misspelled. It was indeed a pleasant surprise for us on our recent Mexican tap to discover and make the acquaintance of others interested in the same things we are interested in, particularly to find another MD interested in and working in the field of parapsychological research. As you well know, a professional man that dares to venture into this area is certain to have a lot of pot shots taken at him, and I admire your courage in devoting your full time to this study. On the evening of August 11th, we received the two enclosed communications, each through a different channel, and we were instructed to forward them to you at once. Author's note, I have labeled these enclosures Test No. 2. We were told that you would understand and would know what to do concerning them. We were also instructed to send a copy to Mr. and Mrs. Arthur Young. After leaving Acambaro we visited the Chicamostoc ruins near Zacatecas where I had a pickup that my wife Lillian and I had lived there about 1200 AD as Indians and that we had been brothers at that time. We had started from the north on a journey which eventually took us as far as Mesa Verde in Colorado, visiting Indian tribes along the way. At Mesa Verde a great spacecraft landed and contact was made at that time with the Brothers of Space. We trust that our paths shall cross again and that which began so strangely in an ancient Mexican town is but the beginning of an interesting association. Fraternally, signed, Charles Laughhead. I just couldn't believe what I was reading, especially when I read the enclosures that I shall describe shortly. I decided to use Peter Hercose's proven ability at psychometry to assess this note. Psychometry is an old term used to describe a form of extrasensory perception. In psychometry, Peter takes an object in his hands and simply recounts whatever mental impressions he gets from it. This is the way in which Peter would work with the police. By touching objects belonging to missing persons, he could get enough information so that the person would often be found. With us was Harry Stone, another telepathic talent, who often worked with Hercose. At 2 p.m. I handed Peter Dr. Laughhead's letter, Test No. 1, sealed in a brown opaque envelope. Here are Peter's psychometric impressions in English. I must tell you, Andrea, this is not a fake. No, it is not a fantasy. These people have found out something. There is a professor here. There is a doctor in here. Engineers. They don't get pay from another country. At this point Harry Stone wanted to participate in the reading. So we handed him the Test No. 1 envelope. I see two lines, like a bloat or ch, but it is two jets. It was red in the beginning, but the fire fumed blue. I see two rows of fire all shooting out with jets. The fire gets so violent that it starts searing me. App, Harry, look into that fire. Harry. Now I see the eye of a hurricane fuming around. I see two men, I think they are two men, but they don't want to show their faces to anyone. They were covering themselves somehow. App, you said that you think they were men. Why did you say that? Can you draw what they look like? At this point, Peter said he would like to make a drawing of what he saw. His drawing showed a figure in black with a pointed cap, but no arms or legs. Harry said that this is the same thing he saw. Hercules, these are people in black, but I also couldn't see their faces. They are in a costume which can withstand thousands of degrees centigrade heat. This is nothing to laugh at. It is all quite serious. App, is that all you get? Peter and Harry both said they were tired and didn't want to work anymore. I handed Dr. Laughhead's letter and the two enclosures to Mrs. Ida Gold, the secretary, and asked her to transcribe them and the tape of the experiment into typescript. She went ahead with this task immediately. An hour later she came to me in great puzzlement and said, Dr. Pugh Harridge, I have been a bonded court secretary for 30 years and have never seen what I have seen just now. Here is the material you asked me to type. It covers 12.5 pages. I did not change the carbon paper but kept using the same one over and over again. Now, look at each of the carbon copies. Notice that page 1 carbon is black and clear. Pages 2 to 9 are good but getting lighter and less clear. Note how pages 10 and 11 are getting very light and still less clear. This continues on the top of page 12 where the first 10 lines are really light and faint. Then as soon as I began to copy the first enclosure, test number 2, the carbon copy from line 11 and on got black and clear, just as it was on page 1 when the carbon paper was fresh. This is impossible. How can carbon paper suddenly get rejuvenated? I examined the sheets and she was absolutely right. The carbon copy of the first enclosure, test number 2, from Dr. Laughhead was in clear bold black typescript. Test number 2M calling, at the moment of our advent, December 31, 1952, your most spectacular phase of work began. We are 9 principles and forces. The nature of our work is to accentuate certain directions as will fulfill the destiny of creation. We use the body or brain of Dr. V. We can and are using other bodies also. Remember the formula, it is vital that you have a personal conference with Dr. L as soon as possible, for it was not accident that you met him in Mexico. We will have more, much more for you. A very similar message, as the reader will recall, was given through Dr. Vinod almost 4 years before. I tried for 2 years to find out if this material had come into Dr. Laughhead's hands from someone connected with my laboratory, but the search was fruitless. I talked thereafter many times with Dr. Laughhead, and he stoutly maintained that the material had come directly from the mouth of a medium whom he did not want to name. But even if Dr. Laughhead had tried to commit some kind of a deception, it could not account for the rejuvenation of a worn-out sheet of carbon paper. I could only conclude that some kind of an intelligence had created this black imprint by means entirely unknown. I was even willing to admit that there might be some reality to Dr. Laughhead's contacts with spacecraft. But the second enclosure that came with Dr. Laughhead's letter was an even deeper mystery. I could not understand this piece of writing until many years later when I was in Israel in 1971. I now give a faithful copy of this piece of writing sent to me by Dr. Laughhead, received evening of August 11, 1956, Laughhead Apartment, Whipple, Arizona, test number 2M. We are in the place where the first of the prophets have had their origins and wherein they shall be gathered in. And they shall be put into a place wherein other people from the planets of many galaxies, and they shall be the gods which shall create worlds without end. And ye shall see them, and ye shall be within the holy mount which is within the galaxy of the Milky Way in the forest wherein the earth shall be put when she is anchored and wherein is the new birth which is prepared for her, and so shall the earth be delivered up. And the people therein shall be freed from the earth and they shall be put into another place wherein they shall be awakened. These events, and those related to Dr. Vinod, were totally beyond my imagination to comprehend completely. At this point I was not fully convinced that these intelligent beings existed independently of the imaginations of all the witnesses who had shared these experiences. When this question was discussed with all of my colleagues, which we did many times, no one expressed the conviction that what had been said was really true and could be accepted as such. It boiled down to the simple fact that there was not enough proof to accept the explanation of the nine for what they were. Now, although proof and therefore total conviction were lacking, I still found myself continually asking, what if it were true?